Newland recalled. That's not the way we were taught. But that's the way you do it in a paramilitary situation. The American effort in Nicaragua steadily unraveled amid revelations that money had been diverted to the Contras from the sale of Hawk missiles to Iran, a sale brokered by Oliver North in an attempt to secure the release of American hostages held in Beirut. Newland watched as the Iran-Contra investigation slowly ensnared his CIA bosses, past and present. His station chief in Bolivia, Jim Adkins, who had moved to Honduras to run Contra operations from the north, was fired from the agency when it emerged he had authorized helicopter flights to carry supplies into Nicaragua. Joe Fernandez was indicted on June 20, 1988, on counts of obstruction of justice and making false statements, although the charges were eventually dropped. Nestor Sanchez, Newland's first mentor at the CIA, was suspected of involvement in the illegal operations while working at the Pentagon, but was never charged with a crime. The Contra debacle was a searing experience for Newland. He disagreed with much of what he witnessed in Central America, but he was bitter that agency officers were being bled dry defending themselves while senior White House officials escaped punishment. But it taught him a lesson that he would apply years later, when President George W. Bush authorized the CIA to carry out the most extensive covert operations campaign in its history after the September 11 attacks. That lesson? Get everything in writing. When we got into things like lethal authorities, detention policies, all of these things, I made sure this was signed up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, he recalls. Why? Because I had been there before. It would be another 5 years before Iran-Contra investigators would catch up to Dewey Claridge and indict him on perjury charges. But before that, he convinced Casey to upend the agency's bureaucracy to deal with a threat that neither the CIA nor the Pentagon had spent much time thinking about: Islamic terrorism. In a 2-year span beginning in 1983, terrorist groups with names unfamiliar to most Americans went on a stunning international killing spree. The spate of attacks began when a bomb ripped through the American embassy in Beirut and killed 63 employees, including 8 CIA officers. Later that year, a truck packed with explosives killed 241 Marines sleeping in their barracks in Beirut, an attack that had been ordered by an underground terror cell called the Islamic Jihad Organization, a cover name at the time for Hezbollah, to protest the military's ill-advised deployment to Lebanon. In June 1985, Lebanese hijackers killed a U.S. Navy diver during the TWA Flight 847 hostage standoff, and in October 1985, a Palestinian terrorist known as Abu Abbas hijacked the Achille Lauro cruise ship, ordering the killing of a 69-year-old American tourist named Leon Klinghoffer. His body was thrown overboard. Struggling for a response, Reagan officials considered giving the CIA the authority to hunt and kill Lebanese terrorists using teams of local hitmen. Oliver North wrote a draft of a presidential finding that included language giving the CIA authority to neutralize militants with deadly force. Casey was intrigued by the idea of using Lebanese hitmen, but his deputy was appalled. John McMahon, who still bore scars from the congressional investigations of the 1970s and had grown weary of Casey's exploits, was enraged when he heard about the plan. He was sure that creating hit squads violated President Ford's assassination ban. "Do you know what intelligence means to these people?" he asked Casey, referring to White House officials. "It's tossing a bomb. It's blowing up people." And, he said, any blowback from a decision to start killing terrorists would be felt not at the White House, but at the CIA. To the rest of the world, he warned Casey, it's not administration policy. It's not an NSC idea. It's those crazy bastards at CIA. But Casey was not convinced by McMahon's objections, and he threw his support behind Oliver North's proposal. In November 1984, President Reagan signed a secret finding authorizing the CIA and the Pentagon's Joint Special Operations Command to go ahead with the training of Lebanese hitmen. But the plan was never carried out, and the finding was ultimately rescinded by Reagan amid opposition from the State Department and the CIA's old guard. Former CIA Director Richard Helms, weighing in from his retirement, told an aide to Vice President George H.W. Bush that the United States should not adopt the Israeli model of fighting terrorism with terrorism. Casey had hoped that the rash of terrorism would end as quickly as it began. But some CIA officers at the time thought that Casey simply didn't understand the new threat, and a bloody Christmastime attack at the El Al ticket counters inside the Vienna and Rome airports in 1985 destroyed any hope that terrorism would fade away. Palestinian gunmen doped up on amphetamines killed 19 people during the airport spree. The grisliness of the attacks was driven home to Americans through the death of an 11-year-old American named Natasha Simpson. A terrorist shot the girl at close range as she lay in her father's arms. Shortly after the attacks in Vienna and Rome, Claridge made his argument to Casey for a new CIA campaign against Islamic terrorism. Claridge thought the agency was in a defensive crouch, and he won the director's blessing to begin an expansive new war. Claridge's proposal was to create a dedicated group inside the CIA devoted solely to international terrorism. It would be a fusion center, where clandestine officers would work next to analysts, piecing together clues about possible threats and gathering intelligence in order to capture or kill terrorist leaders. What sounds like a standard bureaucratic reorganization was, at the time, quite controversial. The CIA is actually a fragmented, cliquish culture, more like a public high school than many inside the agency care to admit. Jockish paramilitary officers tend to shun the nerdy analysts who regard the paramilitary operatives as knuckle-draggers. At the top of the pyramid are the case officers, the spies who go out into the world, who believe they are doing the real work of the CIA and like to boast that they don't follow orders from desk jockeys at headquarters. There was immediate resistance to Claridge's idea from clandestine officers with Middle East experience. They believed that the center would be staffed by officers who didn't understand the nuances of the Islamic world and would create messes that the officers stationed overseas would have to clean up. Chasing terrorists, they sniffed, was police work, better suited to the FBI than the CIA. Finally, many officers simply didn't trust Claridge and saw the center as empire building. The counterterrorist center was, therefore, born amid the similar tensions that the CIA would experience after the September 11 attacks, between case officers in Islamabad and CTC operatives at Langley, between those pushing for unilateral operations and those warning that such operations could shatter delicate relations with foreign intelligence services. Casey ignored the internal objections and approved Claridge's proposal, and the Counterterrorist Center began operations on February 1, 1986. The CTC's birth narrative was familiar. The White House was struggling with a problem it couldn't find an answer for, so it looked to the CIA for a solution. And the CIA was happy to oblige. The creation of the CTC was also significant because, from the beginning, CTC officers worked closely with military special operations troops and allowed the military to be a partner in clandestine missions. The Pentagon's Special Operations Command was founded 1 year after the CTC, and operatives from both organizations viewed each other as kindred souls, imbued with the spirit of Bill Donovan's OSS. Unlike other parts of the CIA, the Counterterrorist Center didn't turn up its nose at the military. The Pentagon's commandos were partners with the terrorist hunters at the CTC. When the Counterterrorist Center began operations, there were no ongoing covert operations against international terrorist groups, and the CTC began working with Army paramilitary units like Delta Force to penetrate the Abu Nidal organization and Hezbollah. Lawyers working for President Reagan drew up secret legal memos concluding that hunting and killing terrorists did not violate the 1976 assassination ban, just as lawyers working for Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama would do decades later. These terrorist groups were plotting attacks against Americans, the lawyers argued, so killing them would be self-defense, not assassination. But getting the legal authorities is only one step, and it doesn't guarantee that politicians will bless specific lethal operations. During the early years of the Counterterrorist Center, the White House had little political capital to spend convincing Congress of the need to kill terrorists in secret. The Iran-Contra investigations had sapped the energies from Reagan's national security team and given more clout to advisors like National Security Advisor Colin Powell and Secretary of State George Shultz, who urged against any more overseas exploits. There was no longer the stomach for a fight, recalled Fred Turco, who was Dewey Claridge's deputy at the CTC and later took over the center. The wheels had fallen off for Reagan. Ross Newland left the jungles of Central America cynical about how the Iran-Contra scandal had shattered the agency's clandestine service. But unlike his CIA bosses, he had not become enmeshed in the unfolding scandal. In fact, he received a promotion. He and several of his contemporaries were elevated to become chiefs of overseas stations in Eastern Europe, jobs that put them in charge of agency operations in various Soviet satellite states. Still in his early 30s, Newland became the youngest station chief in the history of the CIA's division handling Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. In 1988, the CIA didn't see that as much of a risk. "They put us there because they were pretty confident that nothing was going to happen," said Newland. "And boy, did they fuck up." Within a year, the Berlin Wall had crumbled and revolution had spread throughout Eastern Europe. As the CIA's top officer in Romania, Newland was in charge of keeping the Bush administration informed about the collapse of the regime of Nicolae Ceausescu, who fled Bucharest with his wife as crowds swelled in the streets during the week before Christmas 1989. On Christmas Day, with Romanian paratroopers holding Nicolae and Elena Ceausescu in custody, Newland found himself trying to convince the officers of the unit holding the couple not to execute them without at least conducting some kind of trial. At least, that's what Newland's bosses at Langley had told him to tell the Romanian troops. "And so we forced them to go through a trial, and it lasted like 20 minutes, he said. When that formality was dispensed with, the platoon commander asked for 3 volunteers to form a firing squad. But when the Romanian dictator and his wife were put up against the wall, their hands bound behind their backs, the entire platoon opened fire. With the end of the Cold War came the end of the CIA's defining mission. Countering the advance of communism had been the agency's lodestar, justifying decades of far-flung operations in Latin America, the Middle East, and Europe. The budget cuts to the Pentagon and CIA during the 1990s hit the agency's clandestine service particularly hard, with overseas stations shuttered and the total number of CIA case officers slashed. Overall spending on human intelligence collection was cut by 22% over the decade. President Clinton, America's first baby boomer president and a one-time Vietnam War protester, was a natural skeptic of the CIA and gave his spy chiefs little time during his first term. R. James Woolsey, Jr., Clinton's first CIA director, said that Clinton paid little attention to intelligence issues and had private meetings with his spy chief only once a year. "We had very little access, frankly," Woolsey said. After he left the CIA, he joked that the man who crashed a stolen Cessna plane on the south lawn of the White House in September 1994 was actually him trying to get a meeting with the president. The agency was also still facing a reckoning for the aggressive operations in Latin America overseen by Dewey Claridge in the 1980s. In 1996, an Intelligence Oversight Board issued a report detailing the extensive human rights abuses carried out for more than a decade by CIA assets in Guatemala. It alleged that between 1984 and 1986, several CIA informants were alleged to have ordered, planned, or participated in serious human rights violations such as assassination, extrajudicial execution, torture, or kidnapping while they were assets, and that the CIA was contemporaneously aware of many of the allegations. The Guatemala revelations had been trickling out for years, leading CIA Director John M. Deutsch to impose new restrictions on agency case officers consorting with unsavory characters. The drug lords with whom Ross Newland had once bet on cockfights in Bolivia would now be off-limits to CIA officers, as would terrorists who might be attempting to kill Americans. Deutsch, a chemist with a Ph.D. from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, came to Langley from the Pentagon after President Clinton removed James Woolsey from the CIA job in 1995. He wanted to build spy satellites and overseas listening posts, not send clandestine officers on swashbuckling secret missions. He didn't trust the agency's clandestine service, and they treated him like a virus that had invaded the host body. One of his initiatives was to have the CIA work more closely with the military on issues other than counterterrorism, which, by the mid-90s, had returned to being an issue of little importance at the CIA. Since the end of the Gulf War in 1991, Pentagon generals had complained that the CIA had been useless in penetrating Saddam Hussein's regime before the war broke out, and just as bad in helping the military hunt Iraqi forces in the desert. Deutsch ordered CIA officers to serve in military command posts around the globe to make sure that the agency was giving its best intelligence on global threats. Deutsch believed that the CIA's role of supporting the military was so essential that in 1995 he also created a top-level job to serve as a liaison to the Pentagon, a post that would be held by a senior military officer. Some inside the agency joked that embedding CIA operatives inside military commands and flag officers inside the intelligence agency was the bureaucratic equivalent of a hostage swap. The first military officer tapped for the CIA job was Vice Admiral Dennis C. Blair, a wiry Yankee from Kittery, Maine, who had graduated from the Naval Academy in 1968 and went on to Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar, where he became friends with a young Bill Clinton. Blair met resistance almost immediately from CIA officers who were skeptical about the three-star admiral with a dim view of the CIA's track record on covert action. As Blair saw it, the agency should be focusing on collecting and analyzing intelligence, not on black operations that only serve to get the United States in trouble. Going back to the history of CIA covert operations, I think you can make the argument that if we had done none of them, we would probably be better off, and certainly no worse off than we are today, Blair would say years later. Some at Langley saw Blair as a Pentagon mole, but his presence also raised bigger fears that the Pentagon would consume the agency and that the CIA would lose its spot as the president's loyal intelligence service. The men, as Dewey Claridge had said, marched for the president. Blair soon found himself fighting battles with the CIA's Directorate of Operations on the biggest issue of the time, the war in the Balkans. One of the fights was over a new surveillance tool the CIA had borrowed from the Air Force to spy in Bosnia, a gangly, insect-like airplane called the RQ-1 Predator. The CIA had been flying the Predator to spy on Serbian troop positions, and senior agency officers proposed installing video screens inside the White House to allow President Clinton and his aides to watch the live drone feed. Blair admired the CIA's initiative in developing the Predator, but thought it would be a waste of the president's precious time watching a drone feed. He suspected that the CIA's clandestine service was just trying to show off its new toy for President Clinton. "What's the president going to do with it?" Blair remembers asking. And they said, "It needs to go into the White House in case the president wants to know what's going on in Bosnia." And I said, "That's ridiculous. The president is not going to look through this little soda straw." Deutsch ultimately sided with Blair, and the CIA never fed the Predator video into the White House. It was a silly fight, but for Blair, that episode and other battles he fought with the agency's clandestine service were telling reminders that the Directorate of Operations would try to bite any arm trying to block its direct path to the Oval Office. More than a decade later, with another Democratic president in charge, Blair would try once again to get between the CIA and the White House. It would be fatal to his career. Chapter 4. Rumsfeld's Spies. A quote from Deputy Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci in 1982. "We seem to have created our own CIA, but like Topsy, uncoordinated and uncontrolled." A quote from Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld in 2001. "Given the nature of our world, isn't it conceivable that the department ought not to be in a position of near total dependence on CIA in situations such as this?" In November 2001, as teams of American Green Berets, CIA operatives, and Afghan warlords were dislodging the Taliban forces from Kabul and Kandahar, Donald Rumsfeld flew to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, a sprawling base in Fayetteville that for years had been home to large numbers of the military's special operations troops. It was primarily meant to be a day for glad-handing, with Rumsfeld meeting with the Special Forces commanders to thank them for what had been, thus far, a surprisingly easy invasion of Afghanistan. After a morning of congratulations and PowerPoint presentations, Rumsfeld was driven to a walled-off compound straddling Fort Bragg and adjacent to Pope Air Force Base. It was the home of the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, a highly classified organization comprised mostly of Army Delta Force operatives and members of the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, commonly called SEAL Team 6. JSOC was a small operational arm of the larger U.S. Special Operations Command, and at the time the Pentagon refused to acknowledge the group even existed. JSOC put on a show for the visiting defense secretary to demonstrate its ability to insert commandos into countries undetected. Soldiers parachuted out of a plane and landed right in front of Rumsfeld. One of them, wearing a suit and carrying a briefcase, shed his parachute and walked away from the landing zone in his wingtip shoes. Rumsfeld was also taken to a shoot house, where he watched a practice hostage rescue operation. The JSOC operatives pretending to kill off all hostage takers without harming the captives. Rumsfeld was immediately sold. By that point, the Special Operations Group was well experienced in showing off for visiting officials. Years earlier, in 1986, Representative Dick Cheney went to Fort Bragg for a day of meetings with Delta Force commanders and heard about how Delta Force was using databases to mine information about possible terrorism threats. In the middle of a briefing about LexisNexis, the now ubiquitous news and document database that was then a novelty, Cheney asked the military briefer to search the database for his name. The top story was a news article about a bill in the House of Representatives that Cheney had sponsored and how another congressman had said the day before that he would vote against it. Cheney was livid. He ordered the watch officer to track down the congressman, and then, from inside the operations center, he screamed at the man over the phone. "We had to clear the place out," remembered Thomas O'Connell, then a top JSOC intelligence officer, who said that Cheney seemed like a changed man when he saw the power of using databases to gather information about specific individuals. "From that point on," said O'Connell, "Cheney was in his comfort zone dealing with special operators." 17 years later, on a similar pilgrimage to Fort Bragg, Cheney's old mentor Donald Rumsfeld also thought he was getting a glimpse of the future. Accompanying Rumsfeld on the trip was Robert Andrews, who had been at Rumsfeld's side almost constantly in the weeks since the September 11 attacks. Andrews was the Pentagon's top civilian official in charge of special operations, and, like Virgil in Dante's Inferno, he had been guiding Rumsfeld through a dark world which had expanded dramatically since Rumsfeld's first tour as defense secretary during the Ford administration. Rumsfeld couldn't have found a more experienced guide. A folksy native of Spartanburg, South Carolina, Andrews graduated with a chemical engineering degree from the University of Florida in 1960 and joined the Army as part of an ROTC commitment he thought would keep him in uniform for just 2 years. Instead, by 1963, he had joined the Green Berets and began what would turn into 5 decades immersed in the world of special operations and intelligence. The following year, he left for Vietnam as a young special forces captain, bound for the first of 2 tours as part of a covert paramilitary unit running a secret war against North Vietnam with sabotage, assassination, and black propaganda. The group, known officially by the bland bureaucratic name Military Assistance Command Vietnam Studies and Observation Group, or MACVSOG, conducted the largest and most intricate covert operations the United States had carried out since the days of the OSS. Andrews returned from Vietnam and wrote a book, The Village War, about the extensive intelligence networks in South Vietnamese hamlets that the communists had set up during the early 1960s and used to outmaneuver South Vietnamese and American forces during the war. The book was based almost exclusively on interrogation reports of captured North Vietnamese Army and Viet Cong soldiers and the accounts of North Vietnamese defectors. Andrews's book was widely read inside the CIA, and in 1975, just after Saigon fell to troops from the North, he was asked to work at Langley as the head of a team scrubbing the agency's classified analysis of Vietnam. "Essentially, it was looking at intelligence failures," recalled Andrews, who came to realize that America's problems in Vietnam had as much to do with a deep ignorance of the culture and psychology of the Vietnamese as any specific military blunders. He stayed at the CIA for 5 years before leaving to work in the defense industry and begin writing a string of spy thrillers and mysteries, including one called The Towers. The book was about a former CIA operative frantically trying to defuse a terrorist plot inside the United States. On the cover was a picture of the World Trade Center. Andrews was 64 years old when he returned to the Pentagon in 2001, and he was sitting by Rumsfeld's side on September 25th when General Charles Holland, head of U.S. Special Operations Command, or SOCOM, provided the first briefing about how the military would fight its war against Al-Qaeda. Rumsfeld had ordered Holland to come up with a plan for a worldwide campaign beyond the Al-Qaeda stronghold of Afghanistan, and when Rumsfeld gathered his aides around a conference table, he had expected to be told that might be possible. The briefing got off to a promising start when Holland showed a map and ticked off the list of countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Mauritania, even parts of Latin America, where the military believed Osama bin Laden's lieutenants were hiding. Rumsfeld became animated and interrupted the general. "How soon can we begin operations in these countries?" he asked. Holland considered the question. After a pause, he told Rumsfeld exactly what the irascible defense secretary didn't want to hear. "Well, it would be difficult, because we don't have any actionable intelligence," Holland replied. There was another problem. SOCOM wasn't even prepared to fight that kind of war, or any war, for that matter. The command's job was only to train special operations troops, get them ready to fight, and send them off to the Pentagon's other regional military headquarters in the Middle East, the Pacific, and elsewhere. The regional commanders jealously guarded their own patches of the globe and looked dimly at the prospect of SOCOM running its own missions on their turf. Things then went from bad to worse when Rumsfeld asked Holland another question, one he figured might get an acceptable response. When would special operations troops get into Afghanistan and begin the war there? "When we get clearance from the CIA," Holland replied. Robert Andrews looked over at Rumsfeld, whom Andrews recalled was in the process of screwing himself into the ceiling. In a matter of minutes, he had been told that not only did his expensive special operations troops lack any intelligence about Al-Qaeda, they also couldn't even go to the battlefield without getting permission from George Tenet and the CIA. This was something that frustrated Rumsfeld frequently during the months after the September 11 attacks, so often that he once complained to General Tommy Franks, commander of U.S. Central Command and the general in charge of the Afghan War, that even though the Defense Department was many times the size of the CIA, the military was like little birds in a nest waiting for someone to drop food in their mouths. Days after the war in Afghanistan began, he had dashed off an acerbic memo to Joint Chiefs Chairman General Richard Myers. "Given the nature of our world," Rumsfeld wrote, "isn't it conceivable that the department ought not to be in a position of near total dependence on CIA in situations such as this?" Rumsfeld had long been critical of the intelligence agency. In 1998, when he was chairman of an independent commission to assess the ballistic missile threat to the United States, he wrote a letter to Tenet that was a withering indictment of CIA judgments about the missile capabilities of Iran and North Korea. But now, in the midst of a new war, he realized he envied the spy agency's ability to send its operatives anywhere at any time without having to ask permission. "You can legitimately trace the change in warfare back to the realization that we didn't have the intelligence to fight the war we wanted to fight," said Andrews about his boss's decisions in the year after the September 11 attacks. Rumsfeld concluded that the only answer was to make the Pentagon more like the CIA. Donald Rumsfeld's concerns weren't entirely new. In 1980, after a fiery debacle in the Dasht-e-Kavir, Iran's Great Salt Desert, the Pentagon decided it needed more of its own spies. The clandestine mission that April to rescue 52 hostages imprisoned in the American Embassy compound in Tehran was snake-bitten from the start. Three of the eight helicopters involved in the rescue operation developed mechanical problems on the way to the remote landing strip, another crash-landed at the rendezvous point, and, shortly after commanders gave the order to abort the mission, a helicopter caught in a sandstorm collided with a military cargo plane, killing eight soldiers in an explosion that lit up the desert sky. And yet the botched mission in Iran was not, in the military's view, simply a tragic confluence of naive expectations, poor planning, and failed execution. In the minds of some of the commandos who watched their friends die in the explosions in the desert, Operation Eagle Claw had been partly undone by the failure of the Central Intelligence Agency to provide tactical information about what to expect during the mission. Even before its disastrous conclusion, the operation had been beset by fights between the CIA and the military about how to gather intelligence for the mission. The spy agency had already shown it was unable to understand the dynamics of the Iranian Revolution, with CIA Director Stansfield Turner lamenting during National Security Council meetings that the agency had few sources in the country and was largely relying on American newspaper reports and the BBC for information. The Delta Force commander for the mission didn't trust the CIA officers assigned to collect intelligence in Iran before the operation, so he sent former Green Beret Richard Meadows into the country to conduct surveillance of the embassy compound where the hostages were being held. Traveling on a fake Irish passport and masking his West Virginia accent with a brogue, Meadows had cleared customs posing as Richard Keith, a European automobile executive. Of course, the American troops never even made it into Tehran to carry out the rescue, but generals at the Pentagon complained that the Defense Department had no ability to send its own people on clandestine spying missions to help pave the way for commando operations. In a memorandum to the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency in December 1980, one general on the Pentagon's joint staff wrote about a serious and persistent information deficiency and the need for a group of reliable human observers. With the Pentagon making plans for a second rescue attempt in Iran, the Joint Chiefs of Staff hastily created a group of such observers. It became known as the Field Operations Group. The group bore the unfortunate acronym FOG and did very little. The hostages were released on the day of President Reagan's inauguration in January 1981, making another rescue attempt in Iran unnecessary. But even after FOG was disbanded, Army Chief of Staff Edward Meyer saw the need for a permanent cadre of Pentagon spies and, at one Pentagon meeting, barked, "I'll be damned if we ever get caught in another Iranian hostage situation where we can't find out what's going on or where we can't get into the country." The military's Intelligence Support Activity, or ISA, was born. These programs during the early 1980s weren't the Pentagon's first foray into the human intelligence game. But previous spying efforts had been halting, in part because of resistance from top generals and admirals who thought that soldiers shouldn't also be spies. But the Operation Eagle Claw fiasco gave greater leverage to those who wanted to expand the Pentagon's ranks of human spies, most prominently the Army's General Meyer. The intelligence support activity opened an office inside the Pentagon with approximately 50 people, but with ambitions of growing to five times that size. The unit's official blazon featured various symbols to represent the failed Iranian rescue mission and carried the phrase, "Send Me," drawn from a passage from the Book of Isaiah. "Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?' Then I said, 'Here am I, send me.'" The ISA was set up in 1981 with a large black budget, a brash, hard-charging Army colonel as its commander, and the permission to carry out secret spying operations without even having to notify the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They were the perfect ingredients for a toxic recipe. The world of secret operations is filled with Type A personalities, and a clandestine unit with unlimited funds and a vague mission is bound to push legal boundaries. The ISA, run by Colonel Jerry King, was no exception. Almost from the beginning, King launched a number of off-the-books operations around the globe. Undoubtedly, the most colorful was an operation to funnel money and equipment to a retired Green Beret planning a private mission to rescue American POWs suspected of being held in Laos. For several years, James Bo Gritz had been traveling to Southeast Asia to gather information about possible POWs, trips that were bankrolled by Texas tycoon H. Ross Perot. By early 1981, shortly after the creation of the ISA, Gritz believed he had found hard evidence that dozens of POWs were being held at a camp in central Laos. The information had come from a satellite image of the camp taken years earlier, in which the figures B and 52 seemed to have been formed, a possible signal from POWs to whomever might be watching from the sky. He began planning a rescue mission and even gave it a code name, Velvet Hammer. Gritz assembled a team of 25 retired Special Forces soldiers, trained them at a camp in Florida, and sent a separate group to Thailand to lay the groundwork for the mission into Laos. As Gritz prepared for the mission, many members of the ISA contacted him and offered their support. Tens of thousands of dollars worth of camera equipment, radios, plane tickets to Bangkok, and polygraph equipment to determine whether local sources providing information about the POW camp might be lying. The ISA also gave satellite photos and other intelligence information to Gritz's team. Colonel King had begun supporting Gritz without notifying top Pentagon officials. That turned out to be a problem, as the Joint Chiefs of Staff all the while had secretly been drawing up their own plans for a rescue mission at the exact same camp in Laos. The Joint Chiefs' plan called for sending a reconnaissance team of Laotian mercenaries across the border from Thailand into Laos to determine whether there were indeed any POWs being held there. If the mercenaries found proof that the POWs were at the camp, the Pentagon would launch a rescue mission modeled after the Iranian hostage rescue mission, sending a Delta Force team into the camp. When top Pentagon and CIA officials learned about Gritz's parallel rescue mission, secretly supported by the ISA, they threatened to shut the group down. They thought that Gritz's freelancing had endangered the official rescue mission and that Colonel King had gone beyond his brief. As it turned out, no rescue missions were carried out on the camp in Laos, and no definitive proof was ever found that POWs were held there. Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger ordered the Pentagon Inspector General to investigate all of the ISA's operations. Besides the Gritz episode, the ISA had also been secretly running undercover operations in Panama City to monitor General Manuel Noriega and was involved at the margins of an extensive network of front companies used for covert military activities around the world. The network of companies, part of a program called Yellow Fruit, helped enable some of the secret deals of the Iran-Contra scandal that came to light several years later. The Inspector General's report on the ISA was blistering. It portrayed the group as a rogue unit with little adult supervision and documented profligate spending by the intelligence unit, including a string of bizarre purchases, a Rolls-Royce, a hot air balloon, and a dune buggy. The report stunned both Weinberger and Deputy Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci. In May 1982, Carlucci wrote a memo calling the report disturbing in the extreme. Carlucci had arrived at the Pentagon from the CIA, where he had been Admiral Stansfield Turner's deputy and had seen the toll that years of unsupervised black operations had taken on the CIA. "We should have learned the lesson of the 70s," Carlucci wrote in his memo about the Inspector General's report, "but instead, we have created an organization that is unaccountable." He made a comparison to the character of Topsy from Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, a young slave girl whose origins and growth nobody in the book could explain. "We seem to have created our own CIA," he wrote, "but, like Topsy, uncoordinated and uncontrolled." The following year, when American troops were planning to invade Grenada to rescue a group of medical students taken as hostages, the mission commander refused to include the ISA in the operation because he didn't trust the outfit or its leader, Colonel King. As it turned out, American commandos fumbled around the Caribbean island in October 1983 with little idea of where the medical students were being held. "Our intelligence about Grenada was lousy," recalled Dewey Claridge, who was chief of the CIA's Latin America division at the time. "We were operating virtually in the dark." If things weren't bad enough for the ISA, the CIA was also trying to gut its operations. The spy agency was suspicious of the military building an intelligence empire and dismissive of the idea that military officers could be any good at espionage. This partly reflected a wider insecurity at Langley about the Pentagon. Since its founding in 1947, the CIA had been the Pentagon's smaller sibling, dwarfed by the Defense Department's manpower and muscle in the Washington budget wars. The CIA director didn't even control most of America's big-ticket intelligence programs. The constellation of spy satellites and global listening posts that accounted for 80% of what the United States spent on spying was funded through the Pentagon's budget. During his first stint as defense secretary under President Ford, Rumsfeld fought frequent turf battles with the CIA and White House, arguing that if he was paying for these programs, he was going to control them. If there was one area where the CIA figured it had an advantage over the Pentagon, it was in the realm of human spying. So when the Pentagon created a program like the ISA, many at the CIA saw it as a direct threat to the agency's existence. CIA leaders whispered into the ears of members of the Congressional Intelligence Committees that the Pentagon's spies were amateurs and were tripping over CIA case officers overseas. Covert operations could be blown, they said, and undercover officers might die. Of course, the fact that the CIA was trying to undermine Pentagon spying efforts made military leaders distrust the CIA even less and want to expand their own spying operations even more. During one meeting in 1983, when CIA Director William Casey met with the Joint Chiefs inside the Pentagon's secure conference room, known as the Tank, General Meyer was, as usual, complaining that the CIA never did anything to help the military. Casey tried to quiet the general by pointing out that his predecessor, Admiral Stansfield Turner, had been a military man, but General Meyer would have none of it. "Mr. Casey, what you say is true," he said, "but that son of a bitch didn't do a goddamn thing for the military during all his time at CIA. Even after the Inspector General's report, and even after Carlucci tried to get rid of Colonel King's group, it never went away. In fact, the unit would eventually become a cornerstone of Rumsfeld's efforts to dramatically expand the Pentagon's spying operations. By late 2001, the ISA had evolved into the secret spying unit, codenamed Grey Fox, that began working with Asad Munir and Pakistani spies in western Pakistan. Based just beyond the Washington Beltway at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, Gray Fox comprised several hundred operatives working undercover in overseas assignments. They specialized in planting eavesdropping devices in hard-to-reach places. The devices could then link up to the large listening stations that the National Security Agency had set up around the globe. But in 2001, the group was such a little-discussed fringe organization that it had been nicknamed the Secret Army of Northern Virginia. When Rumsfeld first met the commander of Gray Fox and learned details of the group's operations, he said, "If I had known you guys were doing all this before 9/11, I'd probably have thrown you all in jail." But with Rumsfeld now consumed with improving and better coordinating the Pentagon's somewhat meager human spying capabilities, he ordered an increase in Gray Fox's budget and closer coordination between the spying unit and Joint Special Operations Command, the secretive unit that had so impressed Rumsfeld during his trip to Fort Bragg in November 2001. Since that day, Rumsfeld increasingly had come to see JSOC as exactly the secret army he needed to fight a global war. But JSOC in 2001 was in no position to be Rumsfeld's Praetorian Guard for a worldwide conflict. Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 were niche forces, comprising no more than several hundred operatives and unable to sustain themselves for operations lasting more than 2 days. Delta Force trained almost exclusively for hostage rescue missions, and SEAL Team 6 had spent years training for the mission of securing America's nuclear arsenal inside the country if the need should ever arise. Neither had had the training or equipment for far-flung operations lasting weeks or months. Rumsfeld just got the notion that JSOC has this capability to get in anywhere, kill all the right people, and save all the right people. "Why not use this thing?" said Robert Andrews. What he didn't realize was that it wasn't set up for sustained combat operations. But Rumsfeld saw the appeal in JSOC's independence. It could be a strike force answering directly to the defense secretary and the president, not under the control of some four-star general worried about his turf. It could be like the CIA's Directorate of Operations, unburdened by the weight of a hidebound military bureaucracy. If Rumsfeld could throw money at the command, allowing Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 to enlarge their ranks and buy enough equipment for lengthy overseas deployments, he figured he could send it virtually anywhere. But was it even legal for him to do that? The Pentagon's activities are governed by Title 10 of the United States Code, and Congress historically has tried to limit how the military operates outside of declared war zones. This is partly born from concerns that American soldiers operating beyond battlefields could be caught and tried as spies, rather than granted the usual Geneva Convention protections. By contrast, the president can order the CIA, which is governed by Title 50, to send its officers anywhere in the world. Under those rules, if a CIA officer is caught spying in a hostile country, the American government might deny any knowledge of his activities and let him rot in jail. After the Iran-Contra scandal of the 1980s, Congress tried to place even more restrictions on secret operations. The Intelligence Authorization Act of 1991 mandated that all covert actions be authorized by a written presidential finding explaining the need for the secret activity, and that the White House notify the House and Senate Intelligence Committees shortly after the finding is issued to the CIA. And yet the 1991 Act contained a significant loophole. It exempted the Pentagon from these burdensome requirements if the military was conducting